All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight we're going to be doing a movie about the East German Stasi called The Lives of Others. And we have a returning guest who is a bit of a film buff himself. He's been on a number of times in the past. And we'll have show notes and links and all that at our episode page here, actualanarchy.com/219. But before we introduce our guest, I want to check in with Robert. How are things going with you in trying to run a business operation in the East German state of Washington? How are things going over there?
Well, I was hoping to, it is the middle of winter. And I was hoping to be able to sit some of my patrons down inside of a heated area. I don't know if you can imagine it, but there once upon a time were like these enclosed spaces. Humans would make these enclosed spaces to kind of fend off the elements. And we would like allow other people in to come into these spaces, and like businesses would offer that as an amenity to be like, hey, come on in, check out what I got. And then people would come in and they'd sit down or they'd look around. They'd do things like that. Well, then along came a couple of dickwads and they were like, okay, no more of that. And if you do any of that, we're going to shut your ass down. And so then they kind of came up with this arbitrary phasing system where some people are in this phase and other people are in this other phase. And then if you can be in this phase, you could have a certain percentage of your normal capacity. But if you're in another phase, you can't have any or more. And right now, apparently, we're in some phase where there's not any allowed. And so that means that instead of actually having the door closed, we open the door up entirely, letting all the Arctic air come in, freezing me and my staff, while letting the people who are supposedly not going to get sick outside, stay outside in the freezing cold in the name of health reasons. This is the genius. This is the genius of one size fits all rules and the genius of our brainiacs in government and Lord God Emperor Inslee. All praise be to unto him. Super excited about it. I was behind a car on my way home today, a truck that had painted its tailgate, Inslee sucks ass. It made me happy. So yeah, I'm doing great, Dan. My girlfriend is going to make me a blueberry pie tonight, though, so I'm really excited about that. So, you win some, you lose some.
Well, it sounds like things are looking up for you. And yeah, it certainly does seem like there are a number of different phases that keep changing around what they are. And I think that they started adding increments in between them. I remember a few months ago when they were talking about stage one or phase one and then two and three, they started having like phase 1.1, phase 1.25, things like that. And then they went to some color-coded scheme, and I'm not sure exactly what they're on now. But it certainly doesn't seem to be a very scientific approach. But you are a science denier, of course, and you would never want to take advice from, motherly advice like, don't stay out in the cold, wear a hat and keep your hair dry, those types of things. Because in the olden days, it used to be that when you go outside and be in the cold for too long, you would get sick. But now apparently that's a healthy thing, and everyone should be doing that, of course, per diktats, similar to what would happen in East Germany back when the Stasi were sort of running the show. So it's one of those things. It's one of the reasons I actually wanted to do this movie was because it seems as if it's become more and more believable that these types of things are coming here. And this movie is only made 14 years ago, something like that. And I'm sure when they made it, they were not thinking, the United States is going to be doing this in just a decade and a half. But here we are. So I think it's going to be a good one tonight.
Yeah, you got to love history repeating itself. I do, like I said, when I was, we were talking about doing this movie, I was looking forward to all the quaint ways in which the state spies on its citizens. And the effort they had to go to in this movie is quite impressive. They had to have people like following you around. They had a guy, they had two people up in the attic, like listening with all these devices and this sort of thing and that sort of thing. It's so much easier if you can just get your slaves to carry around little listening devices, and then they'll just, you know, you can just turn them on and listen and scoop in whenever you want. It's so much easier just letting technology do the spying for you. But, you know.
Right, right. And that's what we're all about, is technology making our lives easier, including the lives of others who want to spy on us easier. And let's get into the lives of others right after these messages from us, the Last Nighters. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel and also at lastnighters.com. Our show is going to be about the lives of others tonight, so we're going to return to Castle Wolfenstein and discuss a little film that depicts events that we once thought could never happen in the United States. Our guest is John Reed, returning to the show to talk about this Oscar-winning foreign language film, The Lives of Others. It's a movie in which the world, there is no justice and there's no privacy. And it seems as if we're kind of heading headlong into that same world once again here, history repeating and rhyming. But you can find the show notes and more at lastnighters.com/162, as this is the 162nd episode of this here show. John Reed is of John Reed Creative and also ran a website called Libertarianism for Normal People. He was on with us for The Aviator, Reds, and what was that San Francisco film we did with you?
And the band played on.
And the band played on. That's right. Now, we were going to be doing Deliverance on your next appearance. I think that's what we were hoping to do the last time we talked. But recent events with the social media crackdowns and the COVID restrictions and the masking and people reporting businesses not following guidelines and people turning in family members or neighbors for having relatives over for the holidays, things like that, really made me feel like The Lives of Others was a little bit more on topic than Deliverance. Though the insurrection, the LARPing boogaloo that happened at the Capitol, you could argue that Deliverance would fit in with that. But I wanted to do this one, and I think it's got a lot of meat on the bone to discuss. But welcome back to the show. If you want to say a piece about what you do and maybe what your initial thoughts are on this movie before we get into the Google description, how we usually start these things off.
Well, first of all, I think to Robert's earlier complaint about his business, it's his fault for not being a grocery store or a Walmart. So that's on him. Second of all, there's a meme, a popular meme on Facebook, on social media. I see with, you know, Lisa Simpson in front of this big whiteboard, and whatever caption you put in there is supposed to make the point. And there's one I saw where it says a lot of you would have rooted for the Capitol in the Hunger Games, and it shows. And I think with this film, a lot of people today would root for the Stasi, and you can really tell who those people are. So it's a good film to talk about, especially now during these times where everybody seems to be want to crack down on misinformation or disinformation. So it's apropos.
Yeah. All you got to do is replace a writer who actually wants to write about things with science denier, non-mask wearer. He had a party in his apartment and it was against regulations. So yeah.
Or blogger who thinks that there's a pedophile ring in Washington. The blogger who has absolutely no power, no, hardly any audience, but the mainstream media and the cathedral seem to be intensely scared of that person.
Indeed.
Well, it's hard to, when they don't have truth on their side, you know, they're going to be afraid of anything that shines a light, even no matter how small that light is. So it makes sense that they would want to crack down as they do in this here movie. So I'm going to pull up the Google description so we can get this thing started off in a proper sense. So bear with me as my age prevents me from doing this more rapidly here. and adding it to the stream. Oh, look at that. All right. So The Lies of Others, 2006, rated R, thriller slash drama, 2 hours and 18 minutes. Got an 8.4 out of 10 on IMDb, 93% Rotten Tomatoes, 89% on Metacritic, 91% of Google users liked it, and it won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. In 1983, East Berlin dedicated Stasi officer Gerd Weisler, doubting that a famous playwright is loyal to the Communist Party, receives approval to spy on the man and his actress lover, Christa Maria. Weisler becomes unexpectedly sympathetic to the couple, then faces conflicting loyalties when his superior takes a liking to Christa Maria and orders Weisler to get the playwright out of the way. Came out in the U.S. February 9th, 2007. Language is in German, so Robert, my apologies. I made you have to read to enjoy this film. But let's get your take on this with your opening salvo, please.
Yeah, so I'll just remind you that revenge is a dish best served cold. And let's just say that some of my upcoming movie picks will be not so much enjoyable for yours, as in you, as in, I was going to say yours truly, but that would be me. So I mean the opposite of me. I mean you. So yes, thank you for that. Although, spoiler, I really did enjoy the hell out of this movie. Not only was it ripe for discussion in the sense that there's so many things to talk about for us from our point of view, but also it just tells a really great story. All kinds of just loyalties and intrigue and betrayal and humanity coming through. There's so much richness here, and it's all under the pressure of this totalitarian regime that we don't really ever get a sense of. We get a sense of it entirely. We don't see it, as in the actors are all like these kind of petty bureaucrat people, minister officials and whatnot. We don't see like the tippity top people laying down policy and that sort of thing. But we do see the effects of those policies, especially in the sense that they are constantly rewarding people. Like, people's careers are made by finding dirt on other people, and you're rewarding, you know, really, really bad behavior. So it's just like, you know, when there's like a gun buyback, and then there's that one hero libertarian type guy who goes to the Home Depot and buys some PVC pipe, and he puts it all together and he puts it as part of the buyback, and he gets like, he spends like $15 on stuff at Home Depot, and he sells it to the government for like $300 or whatever the gun buyback is. It's like, when you offer an incentive for a thing, you're going to get those things. So the Stasi are constantly looking for enemies of the state, and they reward the officials and the people who find those enemies with like career advancements and that sort of thing. So you're going to get all these enemies, whether or not it's real or true. I would argue that nothing anybody does in this movie is obviously, you know, worthy of the treatment that these people receive, of course, right? I mean, all they are is arguing that the state isn't so great, that socialism has problems, and they can't admit that. Like, they stopped counting suicides in like 1977. So now it's just, I forget what the term was, but it was like murder, self-murder or something like that. Whatever, some kind of ridiculousness. But yeah, the setting is ripe for discussion. There's all kinds of elements that we can get into, from the use of the bureaucrat guy who's using his power just to get away, to get rid of a love interest rival, right? Like, he's got this interest in this actress lady, but she's in love with this writer guy. And he's like, well, maybe this writer guy, he's not as clean as we think he is, huh? Huh? And it just takes a few words, and then somebody's like, ooh, really? This is a chance for us to benefit and for me to advance my career if I can find some dirt on this guy. And that's essentially the plot of the entire movie. And of course, it ends in tragedy. But I think it's all really well made. I can see why it won an Oscar. I didn't mind so much the reading. The only reason I hate the reading is because I'm mostly mildly ADD, and I like to have a movie on kind of off to the side, and I'm mostly paying attention to it, but I'm kind of doing this other thing too, or maybe doing this other thing over here too. And if you're, yeah, subtitles, I have to pause it every time I want to like divert my attention, which is just horrific for someone like me. I like to be able to just kind of pay attention to a thing, but here you have to actually focus on the thing.
Right. Now, as a co-host on a movie review show, I will say that you've already done more movie reviewing in this 1 5-minute dialogue than you do in most entire episodes. So I think the paying attention to the movie itself is pretty key. Maybe we've landed on a ridiculous.
I will protest. I will protest any such things. Never again. No, it's possible. I'll do it again. I will watch a foreign language film. I will watch Korean foreign language movies, as you are well aware. And I think we've watched a few others, but they have to be high quality. I'm not going to sit through some crap where I have to actually pay attention to it. Not going to happen.
All right. Well, we should do some of those old Japanese movies too, like Kurosawa and whatnot, like 3-hour, 4-hour movies, all very similar looking characters, but very deep storylines, lots of reading.
I've never liked you. I've really never liked you as a person. You know what I mean?
I know, you know, and if there was some way for you to benefit from turning me in, I think you might do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If there was a number I could call, I'd be like, you know, maybe Daniel's not as clean as we think he is. You know, he seems like he's a loyal socialist, but maybe he's not.
Right, right. Well, let's get John in on this. Now, John, have a seat in that chair and we'll pull the leather up later, put it in a jar for the dogs. What's your take on the opening here, the Google description, and your thoughts on the film from the onset here?
Well, first of all, if you want to compromise, you can do a Japanese film that's got voiceover dubbed, like Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. That'd be a good compromise. But yeah, it's a really good film. And to Robert's point, I think, like, you know, where the starting point is that all this starts from a guy who's really hot for this actress who's really in love with a playwright, and he's using his power to see what he can do to kind of get the playwright guy out of the picture. So it's a system that's fraught with corruption from the beginning, and the corruption doesn't even have to be financial. It can just be, you know, the guy's just lusting after a hot chick. I mean, hot for East German standards, let's be honest. Yeah, it's amazing because I was watching it again, I was kind of reminded about how social media really plays an impersonal part in our interaction with people that we don't even know. So where I would tie this back from it is that, you know, the Weisler guy who is, his assignment is spying on this couple, you know, at first they're just whatever, people without names, you know, they're people who are potential enemies against the state, and that's all he knows about them. But the more he gets to know them, the more he gets personally involved in their lives and feels, I don't know if the connection is the right word, but he's empathetic toward their plight, toward their lives, and actually takes a personal role in making sure that, you know, their fate isn't disastrous, or they don't wind up in like a gulag later on. So I think it's allegorical to social media in that, you know, we'll fight forever with some person that we don't even know who lives 2,000 miles away from us because they're just a profile picture on our computer screen and we don't interact with them personally. We don't know them personally. We don't know if they're married, if they have children, what kind of a parent they are, what kind of a father they are, what kind of how they treat their parents. You know, they could be very wonderful human being, but when we encounter them on social media, they're just jerks, and we're not even hesitant to give them like a good tongue lashing if we feel that they deserve it. So I think this is really a sign of the times, in that, like, if we had more personal interaction, or if we could kind of get a window into the lives of the people that we don't even know, we might find out, hey, these are people too, just like me. And I think that's the real point of this story here, is that, you know, you could be part of the government, you could be a total authoritarian, you think people should have they should be deplatformed or they should be canceled. But if you really got to know them, you're just like, well, this is just a human being who has a disagreement with me. And maybe they should be able to speak, and maybe they should be able to write whatever they want to write. And I think if a lot more people kind of watched this movie and took that away from it, then our society might be a lot better. But at this point, I think it's better if we all just secede and get away from each other.
Right. Yeah. I think we're past the point of a reconciliation, especially with how low the bar is for calling somebody the worst possible things and thinking the worst things about them. It doesn't seem to take much anymore at all. What I find interesting about Weasler's character, initially, he's very much on board. He's very by the book, very professional, believes in the cause and what he's supporting. And he approaches this assignment as such. However, the mistreatment at the hands of the bureaucrat and at the hands of the East German government, the Stasi, as well, it actually drives these people to become actual legitimate enemies of the state. Like, they were pretty much okay to go along with whatever diktats and whatever the government wanted them to do until they started feeling the brunt of some interventions by the state. And then that's what drove the playwright to actually take action. Like, he had a friend in his ear who was constantly telling him, like, hey, this socialist government's not so good for us. They're oppressing us. Things are actually not so good. And he would say, be quiet. Don't say too much. You never know who's going to be listening. But go along to get along. And I feel like I think you were using the more we as a people, like a society, John. I'm talking about we as individuals who think along similar lines. We tend to be those almost crazy people when we reach out and talk to friends and relatives and things, trying to unscale the eyes so they can see the state for what it is. So I kind of identified a lot with that character who was telling the playwright, like, hey, this isn't so good. You know, they're actually oppressing us pretty bad. And if you're, you know, when you finally get to the point where you want to do something about it, let me know. And they pushed him to that point. You know, he probably would never have resisted. He was probably fine being docile to the end of his life if they would stop messing with him and stop messing with, like, his friend who they blackballed from being a director who ended up committing suicide, and his girlfriend who was being sexually assaulted by the bureaucrat. So it's like the apparatus itself created the enemies with which they justify the apparatus. So it's this self-reinforcing mechanism that's kind of at play here. Your thoughts on that, Robert?
Well, yeah, it just reminds me of how these petty tyrants will play on any kind of human weakness, and then they'll use it for their own benefit. So, you know, the minister guy, he like knows that this girl is on taking this drug to help her perform as an actress. But I don't know who makes it illegal to have this drug, but somehow it's illegal. And it just totally happens here. Right. Also. And then he like not only like looks away, but like helps her get it, I guess, maybe. I'm not exactly clear on how that is, but he definitely looks the other way. Like, he knows all about it and he could turn her in at any moment, and probably is kind of holding that over her as a way of like controlling her. Right. And that's what these tyrants do. Like, no human being is going to live up to the standards that these authoritarian control socialists do. So that everybody, same as here, there's nobody that lives completely by the books, letter of the law life. It's just completely up to the control freaks and the enforcers to whether they want to enforce it on in this situation at this given time. And that gives them power over you. Right. I mean, how many times has, you know, the attractive girl gotten pulled over by a cop and she gives him the puppy dog eyes and he's like, okay, buddy, you know, it's whatever. It's all right. He gets a little bit of a thrill out of that, a little bit of power trip. But then maybe another guy pulls over and he's not giving him the boot licking treatment. And so then he gives him the ticket. It happens all the time, everywhere, at all times, because no one's going to live up to this insane level of rules that you all have to live by, especially in a situation where thought crime is basically illegal in this movie. And I assume this movie wasn't made by anarchists. I think this is just what was the case. I mean, I'm not sure how true to life this movie is, but in the very opening scene, I think like the third line uttered was by the interrogator. And he says, if you think our system is capable of imprisoning people on a whim, that alone is enough to justify your arrest. Meaning, if you even think we're doing anything bad, that's enough to make us want to imprison you, because we can only deal with pure-hearted socialists, and you have to be 100% pro-party, thinking we're the best in the world. It's very much what I hear from coming out of like North Korea, right? Where they just think everything is just the greatest. The world outside of North Korea is an absolute hellhole. And it's just like this mass groupthink. And if you go outside, you stray outside the groupthink, then that's reason enough for them to take you out, because we can't have people thinking that around and spreading those ideas. That would bring down the whole system. It's a very fragile system. The more they squeeze, the more brittle it makes everything. And you have to have incredibly tight control over everybody and every action. And it's got to be exhausting. And that's why another reason why their economies are always absolute dog shit, because people don't perform well under these level of stresses where they completely control everything, your thoughts. I mean, just it's an absolute nightmare scenario. If anybody wanted more reasons to hate these authoritarian type regimes, watch this film. It's a perfect, they don't go into the economics, but they go into people's personal lives plenty, and why you wouldn't want this kind of situation happening in your own personal life.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And they do make it pretty obvious that people would not be happy living under this, but it becomes, like I was saying, this reinforcing thing where the very nature of the system itself creates the enemies with which they use the system against. And so it becomes this self-perpetuating thing. And I think it was Ayn Rand who said, if you need more criminals, then you create more laws and you make more things illegal. And I want to say, there was a book that came out maybe a decade or two ago by Harvey Silvergate called 8 Felonies a Day. And there's so many laws on the books in the United States, at least at that time, that almost every person, the average person, the average American, would commit 8 felonies per day just going about their daily average life. And so all it would take was some interest to be piqued by someone in a position of authority to get anybody for any of these, felonious actions that probably on the surface would not seem like they should be crimes at all.
Yeah, certainly. And that just gives more and more opportunities for these technocrats, bureaucrats, minister type people to exert that influence and corruption over anything they want to get. Right. So, I mean, Everybody is essentially at their mercy when they can just snap their fingers and a group of guys in a black van come and snatch you up.
I want to go to John right after I point this out. My wife mentioned to me that there's this article that the CDC gave guidance. So now the federal government is imposing these restrictions on airline travel. And so now masks are required and all these pages of regulations related to it. But the thing that she pointed out to me was that it's at the discretion of the enforcement officer at the federal level to determine whether you're drinking your beverage, legitimately drinking it, or just using it as a ruse by which you have a reason to not have the mask on. And so it's that exact thing. It's that discretion of the enforcer in this very like rubbery, like law or regulation or enforcement action that gives them all sorts of discretionary authority and power over you. So John, I'll get your take on that and whatever other topic you want to bring up.
Well, I'm sure that the enforcer is well-trained to know whether you're faking drinking or legitimately drinking. So I think that's these are professionals. But yeah, I think to your point, the being at the mercy of these bureaucrats, and you know, thank God that in the story Weisler became empathetic to the lives of these people, and you just can't count on that. I mean, you've got to hope that the guy at the NSA who might be listening in on your phone calls or tracking your text messages or anything is down deep a decent guy and is going to self-reflect and say, my God, what am I doing with my life? I'm spying on these innocent people. But you just can't count on that. And like, while we hope that the government is full of Weislers who are going to one day see the light of day and realize that they've sold their soul to Satan to earn a five-figure salary, it's not, you can't count on that. And it's really better if we don't have this system at all, if we can secede from the system or extricate ourselves from the system and live in a free society. And if other people want to live in a society where they're being spied on by the NSA and want their text messages read, that's great. But that kind of system, kind of, you have to hope that the people spying on you have a heart and have a soul. And like in this story, luckily Weisler did, but it's a really big gamble to think that if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about, because these people are pure as the driven snow and would only use their powers against evil. It's becoming more and more apparent that that's not true. And furthermore, more and more of the population is being supportive of them not using discretionary power, but more bringing down the hammer on those with whom they disagree.
Right. And there's a bastardization of language, and everything is like in the most extreme terms, you know? So there's almost this equivocation with violence being just mere words, and you know, taking a tour, an unauthorized tour of the Capitol is a violent insurrection and an attempted coup. You know, everything gets pushed to these extremes to where they can sort of in their minds almost try to logically justify whatever response they're clamoring for, because it can be wielded against their enemies, their ideological and political enemies. Whereas if they were on the opposite side, they would think that they're doing nothing wrong or downplay whatever it is that they're being accused of. You know, it's oftentimes whoever has the power and wields it against the other is just using it as a bludgeon. But not all animals are equal, right? So it's whichever one is in power is allowed to get away with whatever they would incriminate and hurt their enemies with for doing. It's really kind of crazy.
And incentives will turn good people, like you're saying, you want everybody to be a Weisler, but even good people will be corrupted by the incentives of, well, you know, I mean, Weisler didn't have like a family at home. He didn't have kids. He saw like a prostitute. But what if he had like a family and kids, and kids are going to college, he's got to pay for all that. You know, he's got his wife's bugging him for a house, a bigger house. He's, you know, he's got the pressure to bring home more money. And, you know, he turns this guy in, he's going to get the big promotion and maybe he'll make more money. We see it over and over and over again. When the incentives are bad, you see more bad behavior. So like when all the hospitals were getting, you know, paid more money to report a COVID death, what did we see? Piles and piles and piles of COVID tests, and all these hospitals are getting paid from the feds all kinds of cash. So, and you can't sit back and say, well, all these doctors are just evil human beings. What? They've dedicated their lives to helping people, curing illness, and so on and so forth. So you can't tell me that these people are just scumbags. No, they're responding to an incentive that is creating what numbers, what people are using to make this pandemic look, you know, worse and worse and worse and justify all these lockdown measures. So it's the incentive structure. It's the incentive structure of a totalitarian regime where they are encouraging people to find enemies of the state. And lo and behold, they find enemies of the state for increasingly pettier and pettier infractions, because people are so rigid in their behavior, because they're so worried about every last little thing. It sounds like a nightmare. And no wonder why people were risking death to cross, you know, climb over the wall and get out of the country somehow, some way. So it happens in North Korea as well. I mean, people flee these totalitarian socialist regimes. It's mind-boggling how there is such a massive, you know, young socialist movement. I know that socialists are all about getting free stuff or having the rich pay for everything because, you know, they deserve it or whatever. But all you got to do is like look around the world a little bit and see the people fleeing. I mean, it's the height of hilariousness when like a socialist will talk about Cuba and saying, look at Cuba, look how wonderful it is. Look at all this kitschy, cool stuff. That's all, it looks like it came out of the 50s. It's like, that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing that everybody's driving around in a 1950 Ford. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, people are making rafts out of garbage to get out of there, you know, and it's just wild that people will just claim, well, that's not real socialism, or it's those Western imperialist powers like doing sanctions or whatever against them that's causing all these problems. And while that may exacerbate it for sure, and I'm no fan of government doing foreign interventions at all, and I'm sure it's to blame for certain things, but the very nature of socialism itself breeds this greed and envy, and this totalitarianism and authoritarianism goes hand in hand with it, with this top-down attempt at control and economic planning, which is doomed to fail because they can't calculate, they can't allocate resources appropriately. There's no markets to speak of that would determine where things should be allocated to their best use. You know, it's just an overall terrible situation. And
well, the one thing I will say about, you know, say what you will about the socialists of old, like the Bolshevik Revolution and those people, they knew very well once they put the communist state in place, they would have to work. You know, they would have to whatever their lot in life was, a factory worker or a bureaucrat or librarian or what have you, they were going to have to work to make society work. Whereas today's socialists, their goal seems to be not to work and just, I don't know how they're going to pay for everything, but like let Jeff Bezos run Amazon so he can pay billions and trillions in taxes. But they seem to be very content with the idea of once their communist or socialist utopia is in place, that they can just, their job can be painting murals all day if that's what they want. They, you know, so again, say what you will about the communists of old, but at least they were ready to roll up their sleeves and get some work done. And you can't really say that was the most admirable thing about them. If there was anything admirable about them, you can't even say that about the socialists of today.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And to that point, yeah, a lot of the historical socialist revolutions of the past, they were always about industrializing a rather agrarian society. Right. That's what Lenin attempted to do. That's what Mao attempted to do. Of course, millions died in both situations. If I remember, Pol Pot actually went the other direction.
For some reason, he went the opposite way. Yeah.
To also disastrous results. But, you know, they always have, and this seems to be a truism for any justification for these government actions, is they have the welfare of the people foremost in their minds, that they are benevolent and they are going to be improving society for its inhabitants. If only we could get rid of these enemies who are just in the way and screwing things up and resisting these things. And of course, it just begets more resistance because they're using increasingly authoritarian tactics, which unfortunately I think is the path that we are unfortunately headed on here.
Indeed. Now there was one scene in the film that made me scratch my head a little bit, maybe because the character wasn't a true believer, or he wasn't as well versed in socialist / communist ideology as he seemed to be or should be, perhaps. I don't know. But it was the minister guy, the fat minister guy that had a boner for the chick. He was having an argument at the very beginning at this party for the author guy. They were dancing, the author and the artist chick, after it was like the after party for the play they did. And he goes up, he talks to the writer guy, and he says that people don't change. People will always be the same. And I forget the exact context, but that stuck out to me because don't socialists believe that they can remake man into a new socialist man? To only care about others and put others and put the party and put everybody other than themselves first, that sort of thing. It seemed to be antithetical to socialism, and it stuck out to me. Did you guys catch that? Did that stick out to you at all?
I do recall that, and I think maybe he was using that as a justification for why that person who is an enemy of the state would always be an enemy of the state.
Yes, that's what
I think it was. I think he was specifically talking about Jerska, if I'm not mistaken, the director who was blacklisted.
Right. And yes, he was. The writer was like, "Give him a second chance." It was what he said. It wasn't so bad. And then he was like, "No, no, no. He's going to be the same all the time, no matter what."
Yeah. So I think it's another matter of, you know, the rules are whatever they determine them to be to wield against their political enemies.
Well, remember, I mean, Marx's whole theory of communist society would be eventually that it was a natural evolution. He granted that we needed capitalism to innovate and to get humankind to a certain level of wealth and life. But then he thought that, you know, once the people were working and more industrial, and they would just eventually take over the means of production. When Lenin came along, you know, that was supposed to be the goal. He was supposed to put in an authoritarian state with the goal of eventually they wouldn't need a state anymore. So what we're talking about is not kind of making, originally the idea was not making man into the kind of socialist Superman. It was more along the lines that everybody was going to evolve in that way once they found out what a wonderful society that communism could be. They found out pretty quickly that human behavior or human nature is kind of the opposite of what they think the socialist thinks that the human, the man could eventually be, and they had to use force. So the state in places like Russia or Mao's China never actually went away, because they realized pretty quickly that, nope, doesn't work out that way. You kind of need, if you want your socialist utopia, it's going to have to come at the barrel of a gun.
Right.
As Mao said, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because like Dan was saying, people keeps getting in the way. People getting in the way of your utopia with their other pesky ideas and other pesky wants and desires, like freedom and horrible things like that.
I'm not saying this isn't like true of the Republicans too, but I mean, it definitely seems that your average, or not average, but your more militant democratic progressive voter thinks that, you know, once, if they could only get their system in place, now they have the presidency, the Congress and the Senate, if only they could get all their policies in place, eventually people will come around and realize what a wonderful world this is now that the Joe Biden and AOC have made such a wonderful society. But I have a feeling it's going to turn quite, they're going to find out quite the opposite. I think 2022 is going to be really interesting to see what happens with the House. I think the GOP is going to take it over, but all that is to say that I think that the mentality is that they're burning all these calories to try and make people see the light, as it were. Whereas it's probably just better if we go our separate ways and you live in the society that you want to, and we'll go over here and live in the society that we want to. And we never have to fight each other again. We never have to spar politically over during every election and try to determine who wields power over the other side and try to make them come to heel and see the light as they see it.
Right. Yeah. And I said this meme, I think, to Robert the other day. Was the Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke Training Day meme, where it's Denzel pointing a gun at Ethan Hawke's head and it says, we're healing. And it says, yeah, Democrats and to their political opponents.
Yeah. Now that you've gotten your way, now we need to come together.
Right. But of course, that's all rhetoric, right? Because they say that on the one, you know, one side of their mouth, but then the other side is they want to tamp down on any unsavory speech or unsavory theories or ideas or questions. Anything.
Yeah, I think Biden has feeling in unity from time to time, but I don't hear any other, like anybody on the news programs or anything like that, or on Twitter talking about healing and unity anymore. They're pretty much, No, now we're in charge, bitches, and you're going to pay.
Right, yeah. And I wonder how long the honeymoon is actually going to be for the progressives. I can't imagine, like you had said, maybe to 2022. I don't even know if it lasts that long. I think they have maybe a couple of months before this starts to crack.
Well, hasn't it already, like Black Lives Matter is already pissed off that they feel like they were just used as a tool? I've seen a bit of that.
Yep.
Yeah, there's that. I try not to pay attention to too much stuff on Twitter or even on Facebook. I try to not give as much time to Facebook as I have in the past. And I've also tried to not say as much. I used to engage in a lot of debates with people online. John, I think I did a few on your page back in the day and riled up a few folks, but I try not to do that anymore because I don't want to get, shut down. Like I need Facebook to promote the show and to do some of the other like side hustle type things that I do. And so I don't want to risk not having those pathways and avenues available to me. So in a way I need to self-censor. And that's one of the beautiful things that they've kind of put into place is that we have to be careful about what we say and we control ourselves because they control basically the pathways for communication.
Indeed. Indeed. That's what we end up doing to ourselves out of fear.
I think it was Solzhenitsyn who said that, one of the reasons that the Russian government was so successful at controlling people is because they were able to make them say things that they knew weren't true. So to that, on that level, I think the self-censorship is very much akin to their goal of either making you say something you know is a lie or at least shutting up from telling the truth.
Right. Yeah. I think I saw that Solzhenitsyn quote recently where it's like, they know they're lying. We know they're lying. They know that we know they're lying, yet they continue and they persist in saying these things that everyone knows is not true. Right. And unfortunately, that's kind of where we're at, even in the United States, which I never thought we'd get here. I mean, I knew there were problems when I was growing up. There were always problems. Robert and I would sit on his basketball court and come up with all these solutions. Now, often they were about, well, the government ought to do this. But I think we've learned a thing or two since then. But those problems seem quaint these days.
Yeah, absolutely. No, today with all the, I mean, this past year was just very eye-opening to me in terms of it feels like the country where, you kind of valued individual liberty and freedom of speech, all the things that the left traditionally kind of railed for, they wanted people out of their bedrooms. They wanted to be able to say what they wanted. I mean, if you look at back at the old like Berkeley protest, they were all like free speech, that kind of thing. And it's like nowadays it's they hate free speech. It's so weird the way they flipped it. And then now they're just like full on authoritarians. And these people are just like useful little idiots that help out these horrific policies. They're begging for their own enslavement. And it's a neat trick. I think it was about 10 years ago, maybe more than that, but I was having some discussion and my dad asked me about the United States and the future of the United States. And I was like, oh, I'm not even sure the United States will be around in 30 years or whatever I said. And that's looking more and more prophetic. Not that I don't celebrate that, but I'm not so sure that it won't just straight collapse. Now, usually things collapse due to like an economic way. Like I think Rome pretty much fell due to like mostly economics, but I don't know. What do you guys see? Do you think it'll collapse from some sort of an ideological basis or more like the weight of the debt and the out of control spending and people just be like, whoa, I don't want any part of this. And we'll just kind of like break up USSR style.
I think it's going to be a perfect storm. I think to your point, it's going to be economic because you can't print $6 trillion in a year and expect that not to affect anything. But I also think there's a severe cultural clash going on right now that's really going to come to a head. I think the fissures are really getting larger as we go on. And to your point, whereas like, the traditional liberal ideology always supported free speech, but now they've thrown in a disqualifier where hate speech is not free speech, and certainly not sharing disinformation like the election was stolen, heaven forbid.
the growing list of things that aren't free speech
is not free speech. We have a lieutenant governor here in Delaware, in Pennsylvania, who is a real peach. He recently said that anybody spreading misinformation that the election was stolen, they are not protected under free speech. And that's the Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania who's saying that. So it's really interesting, I think, what's going to happen in the next few years, especially as I don't know if you guys agree with me. I don't think Joe Biden's lasting 4 years. I mean, he goes on television on a regular basis and he can't even read off teleprompter. He's really riding in on fumes here. And I think Kamala Harris is going to be President Kamala Harris within a short amount of time. And that's going to be really interesting. And I think it's the 2024 election is going to be really, really fascinating to watch. And I think if they thought Trump was something to behold, I'm ready to see what the next, because I think it's going to be another populist type of candidate. It's just going to be somebody who's a little more intellectually curious and a lot more well-read than Donald Trump. And that'll be really interesting to see how that plays out, because I really don't see another Mitt Romney or Marco Rubio or whoever, whatever neocon you want to put out there, being the candidate from here on.
Right. Yeah. I keep thinking that those guys from Weekend at Bernie's are actually Biden's Secret Service agents holding him up while he's listening to his earpiece saying salute the Marines.
I think that, the Harris going up for reelection in 2024 will be interesting to see who she goes up against. It'll be interesting. We'll see. I know a lot of times they're looking for a good candidate. And for the past couple of elections, the Democrats have run pretty much nobody. And I don't know, sometimes it's just a matter of that candidate doesn't exist. I'm curious to see who the Republicans get, though. We'll see.
I would say that DeSantis is looking pretty strong right now. DeSantis, the governor of Florida.
Oh, yeah. I haven't actually seen him talk.
No, he's very combative with the media. And if you people, the way Trump did it the last 4 years, people really seem to respond to that. So I could totally see DeSantis being the candidate in 2024.
Right on.
Send you, there was a Vanilla Ice of all people tweeted a 1 minute clip of DeSantis. I'll try to find it and send it to you, Robert. It was pretty good. I'll post it on our show notes page as well. But yeah, okay. It's a page out of the Trump playbook, but I think DeSantis is a little bit more, not incredibly so, but a little bit more intellectually rigorous than Trump ever was.
Well, the whole way that he's handled the COVID situation, where he actually goes to people who know what they're talking about and actually wants to know the science so that he can go back and say, look, we're opening up. Here's why. And all you other people who want to keep your lockdowns going, that's on you.
Right. Yeah. I think that's what it was related to, that old Rob Van Winkle, Vanilla Ice, posted it. And related to those things that are going to contribute to the breakup of the United States or dissolution of the United States, I think you're right. It is a perfect storm of all of these competing events that are all happening right around the same time. So basically, there's a ton of comorbidities, but I think the actual cause of death listed on the certificate is going to be COVID.
Very well could be. That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Anyway, are there any other notes that anyone wants to bring up? Because we are getting a little bit long already on this, and maybe any notes about the craft of this film. I know that you've studied film, John. Does this tick a lot of boxes in film craft for you?
Yeah, I liked. I was always a big fan of the photography aspect of film and the cinematography in this case, but the very bleakness, the way it was filmed. I mean, this has a lot to do with, the art direction of the film, the way everything was very banal in its architecture, in its decor, in the way the people dressed, that bar that Weisler went into after his shift was over, the one where he accidentally met up with Krista. I mean, how bleak was that bar? I mean, there was just not even a neon sign anywhere that said open or Budweiser or anything like that. So I thought it was very in the contrast between that and after the Berlin Wall fell, when Weisler came out of the building that he was delivering mail to and he saw graffiti everywhere. Just the sharp contrast in the way that, you know, the communist society in the post-communist society. So, yeah, the way it was filmed, the art direction of it, you know, I'm just a big fan of, and, you know, it's just a really a great story because, you know, the way it starts out, you know, the guy is basically teaching a class on interrogation and how to break somebody. And then, you know, he once he hears the Krista and Georg interact for a few times, you know, he finds a heart, you know, he actually finds sympathy for people when that's not his job. His job is to support the state, and anybody who gets in the state's way is supposed to be eliminated or curtailed. And yeah, you mean going into the movie, you probably weren't even expecting that, but it's really a profound, it's well shot, it's well directed, and it's a great story on top of it.
Right. And I think there's a lot of subtlety to the performances as well. You can definitely see Weisler as this very, you know, by the book, very technically accurate in what he's doing and a true believer. And so for him to be finding humanity through his experiences of listening to these other people trying to live, you know, the best lives that they possibly can under these conditions, he finds sympathies for them and empathy and actually it gets more in touch with his own humanity. And he covers for them in a number of ways. And, you know, especially with, I liked that there was that ending where Georg, like years later, almost meets up with Weisler and decides against it after he discovers that it was Weisler who basically covered for him for hiding the typewriter and they had the red ribbon and his thumbprint was on there. I liked that little epilogue in this and that he dedicated the book to him knowing that eventually he would see that book. And that was more meaningful than, you know, perchance meeting on the street, thanking him. Like it's more indelible in that way. And even more poignant.
Indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. First, yeah. I wanted him to jump out of that car and be like, have a conversation with that guy. There's so much to you to talk about. But the way they ended up doing it was nice.
Yeah. So a well done film. And John, that was almost like a good final summary right there. So do you want to throw like a number of red ribbons, typewriter ribbons, or pages of your manuscript on that as far as your score out of 10?
Oh, yeah. I really like the film. It's actually, I haven't seen it since it was rentable back in the day. I guess it was like 2007, 2008. So it was great to watch this again just for this reason. So yeah, I'm a big fan. 9 out of 10.
All right, very good. All right, Robert, what's your take? How many jars of sat upon leather are you going to be feeding to the dogs for this one?
Yeah, I thought that was so clever when they said, yeah, save that later for the dog scent. That's some good authoritarian horribleness. But This film is quite excellent. I think any good story is going to create high tension in a scene just by throwing two characters into it that the audience knows are on, you know, different or based on where those characters are at in the story. So I'm reminded of season, I think, 7 Game of Thrones, where there's this battle outside of King's Landing where you've got Dany coming in with her army and then you've got Jaime with his army and you didn't know who to root for. You were conflicted. The audience was conflicted about what they wanted to happen. So in this movie, there's a great scene and there's multiple great scenes in the film based on all the backstabbing, or not necessarily the backstabbing, but the shifting allegiances and that sort of thing. So Weisler, the ultimate interrogator, gets a scene where he's interrogating the girlfriend, where he knows he doesn't want her to reveal the location of the typewriter, but as an interrogator, he has to get her to reveal the location of the typewriter. As soon as they walk in, as she walks into the room, and he's in there, and you know what his job is to do because he's being observed by his boss. It creates this fantastic scene where there's a lot of tension and you're like, oh, I hope he doesn't get her to reveal it. Oh no, she revealed it. Oh no, right. What's going to happen?
Not only that is that it's revealed to her that he's the guy she met at the bar. And you know that as an audience. Right.
Exactly. They recognize each other. She recognizes him at least. So yeah, there's all these layers based on how the story is told that just comes together really in a really satisfying way. So anytime you get a story where the writer really plays with these changing allegiances and changing motivations and where characters are at in the different parts of the story and putting them together in interesting ways, it really comes off as a satisfying way. So yeah, this is a fantastic film, totally worth a watch, worth a read. You know, it's got tons of interesting things. If you are just a fan of history, if you are a fan of history not repeating itself, if you are sympathetic, if you live in the United States or even in the world in 2021, and you are seeing a lot of this replay. So this is worth it for anybody who is an ardent socialist, if they want to see some real socialism in action. And I'm sure they'll say this is not true socialism or whatever the fuck they say, but show me a real world with real human beings where this isn't social with how socialism ends up. But this is an 8.4 out of 10. And yeah, check it out. It's real good. Real good. Great acting. Great direction. Fantastic writing. Excellent subject matter. Great setting. It's just all the good stuff. So check it.
All right. And only an 8.4 with all those accolades. Well, I'm going to give it a little bit of a higher score, probably closer to what John gave. But I do think that this was a very well-done film and a very timely film. And it does play with a lot of tensions. And it does, I think, showcase a lot of the horrors of what goes into trying to control people with totalitarianism and a lot of the mechanisms that are in play. And one of the things that stood out to me was when the little boy got on the elevator with him and he revealed something about his dad saying something negative about the state. And this was when Weisler was right on the cusp of like starting to have empathy and regain some humanity. And he asked for the father's name. And then he says, well, I mean the name of the ball. So he's like, he was on the cusp of turning in the dad and making that dad disappear or go into the interrogation and, you know, the 48 hours of no sleep. And I mean, you can get people to almost admit to anything under the sufficient amount of torture. So all of these tactics are, of course, just to brutalize people. But like John, you were saying, you can't count on the NPC who's enforcing these things to actually identify with this humanity and end up being the good guy. I think that a lot of these people go along to get along, or they're true believers into what they're told. They've been propagandized sufficiently enough and are not independent thinkers enough to break free from these things. And that's kind of one of the challenges that we face, is that so many people are willing to just go along with what their superiors tell them or what authorities tell them. And we've seen that time and time again, especially with the COVID restrictions and lockdowns and following the science and the flip-flopping on those high priests of science and whatever they said most recently is taken as gospel. It's kind of crazy when they flip-flop just a few days later, like Herr Fauci did just a few days ago on the double masking versus not double masking. I thought that was pretty funny. But overall, I love this film. It's great. It's got a lot of great scenery, great acting, a lot of tension, like Robert was saying. So I'm going to give this 9.5 out of 10 masks I'm wearing concurrently. And if I gave it a full 10, I'd just put the box on and strap it to my face. But 9.5 masks for this one.
So you can breathe real well through those masks, can you, Dane?
Yeah, I might go for a run and try to climb over a wall to get out of the country. But anyway, this was a really good discussion, and I actually have more things that I want to talk about. Maybe we can do that in the Kathleen Turner Overdrive before it gets too much later, as John's on the East Coast and he's getting older by the minute. But Robert, next week I want to lighten the mood a bit. With the return of our friend Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast, as we celebrate the Chinese New Year with an extra helping of Kurt Russell. Big Trouble in Little China.
Very nice. Very fun. That's a movie I haven't seen in a dog's year. More than that. Way more than that. Maybe a couple of dogs. Maybe a dog's lifetime. Holy smokes. Yeah, it's been a long time. But as I recall, a classic, a lot of fun, a movie that doesn't take itself too seriously. It's just out to have a good time and play with a bunch of tropes and different things. So, yeah, let's do that. I'm excited.
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun. And I'm going to be watching it with an eye to how much of it would be considered offensive today, because I'm sure there's a fair amount in that. So that'll give us plenty of fodder to discuss.
There has to be. There absolutely has to be. It's made back in the day. So,
right. And Kurt Russell, he's a badass. So I'm a big fan of that guy. And he's also a bit of a libertarian. So that's helpful as well. As is our buddy, John Reed, who has joined us for this episode, among others. And I hope you can stick around for a little bit of Patreon bonus content called Kathleen Turner Overdrive. People can get their hands on that at lastnighters.com/Patreon. And you can also find the show notes and more for this and all of John's prior appearances at lastnighters.com/162. And we'll be back next week with our buddy Snobby Bobby for a little bit of trouble in China, little China. So with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. We'll see you next week. Peace out. All right, we're going to continue the transmission for a little bit longer on the Actual Anarchy podcast before we get to that Kathleen Turner Overdrive that I was threatening you with a few moments ago. There were two points that I had intended to bring up during the show, but I'll just bring them up now. Number one, and this sort of relates to the movie and to the COVID pandemic and the reaction to it, is that one of the key points in the film is the revelation by publishing in the Spiegel magazine the suicides that are occurring in East Germany and the fact that they stopped counting them because it was casting an unfavorable light on the system of government there and socialism in general. And so rather than, you know, in contrast where they calculate everything else, like to the number of books you buy and shoes that you wear or shoes that you buy in a year, they conveniently just stopped counting deaths. Sort of like in Cuba, when people point to the infant mortality rate being so much better than the United States, well, it turns out that they actually just stopped counting them as infant deaths. And so it made the numbers. They juiced the stats to make these things look better. Similarly, they juiced the stats with the COVID stuff related to the number of deaths and the number of cases and all those things to drum up fear and justification for a lot of the problems that or the lockdowns and other interventions that they've gone through. But on the other side of it is a minimization of all the impacts of these interventions. And that would be increased opiate addictions, drug abuse, suicides, overdoses, suicide attempts, suicidal ideation, and all of those things. And that reminded me very much of what we see in this film. Robert, do you have a take on that as it relates to current events?
Well, yeah. So that, when these authoritarians always want to institute these new policies, they always have to justify them in some way, right? It's like, yes, this is a heavy-handed approach, but don't worry. Socialism is just amazeballs. You're going to love it so much. It's just going to be incredible. Yes, I know I'm heavy-handed. Yes, we got the Stasi locking everybody up. Yes, we got laws against every little last thing, but it's all worth it in the end. So you got to minimize all the bad things because you're basically claiming that, well, socialism is so incredible. It's going to be so much better than capitalism. So all these horrible things that we're doing is going to be totally worth it. So any times when you actually institute it all, you have to pretend like it really is that amazing, right? Because otherwise it's just worse what we had before, but worse, right? So you're just like, you know, no, everything's wonderful. So, and then they love gaming the numbers. Like, I mean, all these statistics, all they do is lie all the time, whether it's climate change, global warming, or suicide rates, or unemployment numbers, or just name the number, and there is some fudging going on based on what they're selling, what they're using that number for. So if it's global warming, they'll start the chart at a specific time, and they won't show the chart that's been, you know, over, you know, the past 1,000 years, they'll just start this chart at like 1977 or whatever looks the most favorable for their agenda is what they will do. So this is what you get with anybody selling any kind of horrible system. You know, you don't you can't just convince them like, hey, this is going to improve your life. You have to scare them or directly lie to them and say that, you know, this is all really rainbows and roses. Good job, everybody. You're living the dream. But in reality, you're starving. You're too afraid to go outside. You're 3 inches shorter than your neighbor. I mean, you know, because you can't eat. It's a nightmare. But you're being propagandized into that it's wonderful because, you know, they have to justify their horrific policies.
Right. Well said. Well said. And John, I know that you have a perspective or an advantage of a perspective related to medical facilities and how they've kind of been impacted by these things. Have you noticed anything related to like numbers sort of being misrepresented or distorted in some ways to justify things or even just, you know, in your reading of the headlines and whatnot over the last year?
Well, I haven't seen, as far as the organization I work for, I haven't seen any like manipulation. I don't think that the people would do that. You know, the people I work with would do that. What I will say is that as much as I have, you know, read about coronaviruses and about respiratory viruses and the kind of epidemiology expert and aspect and the data that shows, you know, whatever the cases, what that means, the PCR cycles, what that means. I've read all this, and the people with whom I work, who are very accomplished physicians, nurses, and just all around in the medical profession, don't seem to have a clue about any of this. And it's really shocking to say, but I'll just tell you about a conversation that I had. I was in the hospital one day, one of the hospitals, and I was meeting with somebody who's the director of the neurology department. He's not a doctor, but he's like an administrator. So, but he's mired into the medical profession. This is like November, early November, when this fall surge in Pennsylvania started, was just beginning. And he came in, he looked like really disgruntled. And I asked what was wrong. And he said, COVID cases, you know, they're going up again. You know, it was a Monday. And he said, Friday, we had 15 COVID cases. Now we have 35. And it's just off. And I said to him, well, then this seems just to be seasonal, right? Like the flu or like other, like the cold virus. And he said, and not satirically, he just said, you think? But I was just flabbergasted because I said, how does a dummy like me come to the conclusion that this is seasonal? And you who make your life out of patient care and understanding medicine and disease, like you don't know anything about this. Like he was shocked when I told him Sweden was down to about like zero deaths a day. It's just amazing to me, especially the people in the medical profession who should be keeping up on this stuff. The number of people who have no curiosity about something that has just turned their lives upside down and thrown tens of millions of people out of work and just ruined all these small businesses and fed all this money to Amazon and Walmart and Target. They have no curiosity about any of this. And even, is it all worth it? And it's really been disappointing, I think is the most polite way to say it. I've been so disappointed in people, and it doesn't end with people in the medical profession with whom I work closely.
Yeah. That kind of strikes a nerve with me because it goes in with, you know, most people are sort of NPCs, you know, they're sort of programmed to just go along with whatever they've been told or propagandized to. And Michael Malice has been saying recently that they're just like trees, you know, you can kind of avoid them and you don't need to worry about them too much. But I kind of disagree with them on that. I think that they affect your lives incredibly, especially in a quote unquote democratic society. Like when the majority of people go along with whatever these authoritarians say or these experts, quote unquote experts say, it affects your life materially. I mean, unless you have a way of like insulating yourself and mitigating those effects, I think that you have to have an awareness of what the unthinking masses are doing and what they're agitating for, because it will in fact, affect you and impact your life.
And I think, again, going back to how disappointed I am in people over the past year, like people who I've known for years and who, even if I disagree with them politically, who I thought would have some level of intellectual curiosity and are very much invested in, you know, living a happy life. How much, you know, as much as information as I put on my Facebook feed, and for the past year, it's been almost nothing but COVID stuff and data and look, this isn't necessary, and masks don't work and everything. And I know all these people have basically muted me on social media because they don't respond. And every time they post anything related to COVID, it's always like, oh, well, how wonderful Fauci is. And he just said this. And oh my God, thank God for the vaccine. And all this going along and bootlicking to and bowing, taking, bending the knee to the state, it's really disheartening. And it just makes me more and more assured that we just need to go our separate ways. And because I don't want to be politically tied to these people anymore. I'm happy to be friends with them. I'm happy to associate with them, but I just don't want to share a political system with them anymore. And I hope that that day speeds along quickly, because I don't know when this COVID's going to end. I assume that Joe Biden has to be the guy who frees us from our masks and who allows us to go back to a normal life. But that better happen pretty quickly. Like if we're still in late summer and we're still wearing masks, I don't know what it's going to take for these same people who are so willing to double mask or triple mask or whatever. At what point, what's their breaking point? At what point do they say, hey, you said the vaccine was a bridge to normal life. So we got the vaccine now, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people are vaccinated. What's going on here? Like, I can't even trust that that's going to do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, we know for sure that it's going to be at least 100 days after January 20, because that was his promise, was to do the 100 days of masking. So you can't back down before that time.
And I don't think he will at all. I think the playbook is to, even after you have the second dose, there's still all the different mutations. And so it'll just be for the foreseeable future. And it'll further divide people. Animosity against the mask free, it'll just increase against the people who won't take the vaccine will just increase. And
one light at the end of the tunnel I see is that, you know, more and more of people who would have never done it before January 20th, like Cuomo, Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago, and all these other Democratic governors are saying, like, no, we need to open up. Like, we can't do this forever. We need to open up. So, you know, mutating viruses be damned. Like, I think there's going to get to a point where, again, like, Joe Biden has to be the savior who gets us out of our masks and who lets us go back to enjoying concerts and restaurants again. And he certainly can't lord over a tanking economy. So I don't see how they carry this on going into the late summer, for instance.
Right. They have political cover now to let up after the 100 days, I think.
Right.
We'll see. I think it's just on everybody in as an individual to just ignore these assholes and live your life. But, and then, you know, be the leaders, and then they'll always follow us. I mean, I don't think, you know, what's his name was too far off when he said that politics was downstream from culture. Yeah.
Breitbart.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a strict one way street, but because obviously authoritarians can institute policies and then a whole bunch of people will just follow along and that'll become culture too. But it definitely can go culture to politics. Absolutely. Like the way gay marriage, you know, was, as soon as 51% supported it, and all of a sudden all these politicians come out and is like, I've always been pro gay marriage. You know, that's how it goes.
Right. Right. Well, this has been a very sobering discussion overall related to this movie and current events. But I thank you both for being on for this one. This is episode 219 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/219. You can also support us on Patreon and get some of that pre-show bonus content of us futtering around with technology, trying to get it to work properly. And a little bit of the Kathleen Turner drive right after this, though it is getting late for our guests, so I don't want to keep them too long, but I do have a few more things to discuss. And we'll be back next week with the great Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast, which I highly recommend. Do check that out. You can find it on SoundCloud. And he will be talking about Big Trouble in Little China with us for the Chinese New Year. And with that, I'll bid you all adieu. You support the show by subscribing, giving us likes and thumbs up, sending us messages, movie suggestions, or your fiat dollars on Patreon, and visiting our show notes page and seeing the previous appearances of our guest, John Reed. Also, he was on for Full Metal Jacket recently, which was a really good film as well. So Red's Full Metal Jacket, The Aviator, and the band played on. And eventually we're going to be doing Deliverance, I think. And that will be another good one as well. So, John, thanks again for being our guest. And hopefully you can stick around for just a few more minutes after this for the Caffeine Turnover Drive. And with that, we'll say maximum freedom to everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.